Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
It's 12:37. Let's take a look now at weather. A blustery west wind will bring in drier air to the region this afternoon and evening. Temperatures will stay above average through tomorrow. A cold front will push across the Midwest Thursday, bringing us our next chance of precipitation. High temperatures today will range from the mid-30s over northern Wisconsin to the upper 50s across western Kentucky and southern parts of Missouri and Illinois. Low temperatures tonight will range from the low 20s in northern Wisconsin to near 40 degrees in southwestern Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, mostly cloudy and breezy. Look for a high of 45. The wind from the southwest at 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 32. The wind will be out of the southwest from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and warmer with a high of 52. The wind from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low of 40. The wind will be from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers. The high 52. The wind will be out of the west from 15 to 20 miles per hour. Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers. The low will be in the low 30s. Friday and Friday night, mostly cloudy and cooler with the high around 40 with lows in the mid-20s. And the outlook for Saturday and Saturday night, partly cloudy. Look for a high Saturday in the upper 30s and the low Saturday night in the upper 20s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois ranged from the upper 30s to 50 degrees in Carbondale. Most locations reporting a cloudy sky. At Rockford, 37 degrees. At O'Hare, 40. Bloomington, 41. In Mattoon, 45. Carbondale reported 50 degrees. At South Bend, 42. In Terre Haute, 47 degrees. Indianapolis, 46. Lafayette, 45. At Willard Airport, at the top of the hour, it was 44 degrees. The sky cloudy. The dew point, 40. The relative humidity, 85%. The wind out of the southwest at 17 miles per hour, gusting to 25. And the barometric pressure, 29.77, and steady. And at 12:40, 43 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Governor Pat Quinn will lay out his priorities for state spending tomorrow. He's already hinted that it will involve a 9% reduction to most state offices and agencies, cuts in the program that provides health care to the poor, and state facility closures. But as Amanda Vinicky reports, his track record for implementing his ideas is lackluster.
For weeks, months even, before the annual budget address, employees of the governor's fiscal office work late-night shifts and come in on weekends, running numbers and drafting the governor's spending proposal. If this year follows tradition, they'll compile it into a book filled with how much money Quinn wants to give or take away from state agencies and programs. You can still find a copy of last year's online, but much of what's in the 472 pages never came to be. For all of the hard work put into it beforehand, legislators chose to ignore much of Quinn's proposal. Here he is last February announcing his budget plan.
We are reducing the Medicaid reimbursement rate for hospitals and nursing homes, saving taxpayers $550 million this year alone.
That never happened. Neither did this.
Illinois currently has 868 school districts, and our fiscal reality demands consolidation.
Or this.
We have $8.7 billion in overdue unpaid bills. We need to restructure our debt, a plan that will allow us to pay our outstanding bills.
It's not the first time. Quinn talked about resolving that shortly after he first became governor in 2009. Instead, there's still a backlog in the billions, and vendors continue to wait for the deadbeat state to make them whole. Each year, it has been legislators who largely crafted and shaped the budget. The budget that's now in effect was designed by the House. Quinn's fingerprints are only visible where he vetoed it, like cutting state spending on school buses. That's not to say the governor hasn't had successes. There's some debate as to how much credit he deserves, but a big statewide construction program was passed during his administration, as was an income tax hike. Still, much of Quinn's platform never got off the ground. Republican Representative Dennis Rebelletti of Elmhurst says he thinks part of the problem is that Quinn doesn't work closely with the General Assembly.
You know, we're equal branches of government, and that we need to put forth a plan. We need to get a sponsor on the floor, and let's debate the issue.
While they were quick to abandon him after his downfall, Quinn's predecessor, Rod Blagojevich, always had key allies in the House and Senate who championed his causes. And while Blagojevich focused on state programs like his signature health care expansion for kids, Quinn has developed a reputation for flip-flopping, introducing a plan only to drop it in favor of a different one. Again, Rebelletti.
He talks about the bigger picture things, never gives any details, and you kind of sit there and say, you know, it's 2012, we need you to be engaged. And I haven't seen that yet.
This is not a unique characteristic to Governor Quinn.
That's Representative Sarah Feigenholtz, a Democrat from Chicago.
It's occurred also with all governors who opine and stand at the head of the chamber when they deliver their State of the State address or State of the Budget address. They introduce some ideas that may or may not come to fruition, but it does afford an opportunity to come up with other ideas and alternatives.
But Republican Representative Bob Pritchard, who's from the DeKalb area, recalls it differently.
In previous years, there have been governors who had goals and agenda, if you will.
With 118 legislators in the House alone, Pritchard says getting agreement is like herding cats. He says it's up to the governor to set a vision. Pritchard says it's one way Quinn is like Blagojevich.
Budget addresses haven't really had that strategic, goal-oriented perspective. And it certainly hasn't been a fiscally responsible objective. And that's why I think over the last decade, the governor's budget addresses have become much less valuable to the legislature.
Pritchard says it's a good sign that recently the governor's office met with Republicans about challenges and solutions. Quinn and legislators will be forced to deal with budget issues differently this year. A new law means the governor can't base his proposal on anything but existing taxes and revenue sources. And spending must be balanced, or the income tax hike would be repealed automatically. All incentives designed to ensure that no matter what Quinn says in his budget speech, he and the General Assembly will have to craft the state's next spending plan with an eye on reality. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
Illinois Public Media will carry the governor's address live tomorrow at noon here on WILL AM, on WILL TV, and online at will.illinois.edu. Illinois Public Media News is always online at will.illinois.edu. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/WILL Radio TV online. The March issue of the medical journal Pediatrics features a striking editorial that begins with this sentence: "A new pediatric problem is in town." That new problem, according to the editorial, is gender identity disorder in children. Pediatricians are apparently seeing more children with an interest in changing their gender, NPR's Alix Spiegel reports.
15 years ago, most pediatricians in America had never encountered the idea of gender identity disorder in children. But things changed quickly.
We have had a lot of patients come to their doctors and say, "My boy child says they want to be a girl sometime," or "My girl child says they want to be a boy."
This is Walter Meyer, a child psychiatrist at the University of Texas Medical Branch, who wrote the editorial in Pediatrics. Now, to be clear, it's not that Meyer is arguing that there's been an actual increase in the number of children who struggle with gender identity disorder. He says there have always been little boys who want to dress in dresses and little girls who can't stand them. It's just, he says, the social climate has changed.
This behavior used to be ignored by parents. They didn't used to come to my office at all, because I think the parents really accepted this as just normal exploration and ignored it.
Meyer says parents assumed that the little boy who played with dolls might grow up to be gay. But though some were desperately unhappy about that, it wasn't necessarily a medical issue. Then, according to Meyer, came the media.
From the moment we're born, our gender identity is no secret.
This is a 2020 episode about GID in children that aired in 2007. According to Meyer, GID in kids became a popular media subject about 6 years ago. And all of the coverage has really changed the way that parents interpret a certain set of behaviors that have always been present in children.
Because of all the publicity around gender identity disorder, they now are worried that their child has something seriously wrong with them. So they bring that problem to their pediatrician.
Now, ideas about how to treat children with GID have been rapidly evolving. In the past, psychotherapists tried to force the child to accept their biological sex, but many psychotherapists now feel it's best to free the children, allow them to transition to living as the opposite sex. Some therapists encourage transition even when kids are very small, as young as 4. But Meyer says most experts think it's best to delay the decision.
Most of us believe that the child should be allowed to explore the option, not encouraging either path.
So the editorial in Pediatrics, which appears alongside 2 GID studies, is an attempt to increase pediatrician awareness of treatment options since kids are showing up in pediatric offices. But Lisa Schwartz, who researches how medical communication affects the use of medical treatments, says the editorial itself could have an impact on the number of children diagnosed and treated.
Increase in awareness, I think, can play out in 2 ways. I mean, it can help some people, and I think it can hurt others.
It's possible that as more pediatricians become educated about GID, they will use that education to diagnose and treat more patients. In most cases, that's fantastic because kids desperately need help processing their experience, but
it's clearly possible to cause harm by overdiagnosing and overtreating children who are either just transiently curious, experimenting, or just different.
Almost no actual GID experts are very concerned about this, however. They say GID is very far away from being overdiagnosed. But what's clear is that our experience with GID in kids is changing. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 21st of February, 2012. It's the birthday of Anais Nin, born in Douai, France, 1903, studied psychoanalysis, was a patient of Carl Jung at one time, wrote in obscurity for most of her life until her diaries began to be published in 1966, diaries that were written over a period of 60 years. It's the birthday of W.H. Auden, York, England, 1907, son of a physician, went to Oxford on a biology scholarship, switched to English literature. He met poets like Cecil Day Lewis, Stephen Spender, Lewis McNeice, who became his lifelong friends, and just before the start of World War II, emigrated to the United States to teach English. It was on this day in 1925, the first issue of The New Yorker came out, founded by Harold Ross and his wife Jane Grant, a reporter for the New York Times. Ross, the editor-in-chief, until he died in 1951. In the second issue, the editors published an apology for the first one. They said there didn't seem to be much indication of purpose, and we felt sort of naked in our apparent aimlessness. Circulation had dropped to 12,000 by the fall of 1925, but then it started to turn around after Ross hired E.B. White and James Thurber. Gradually, the magazine stopped dropping famous names and developed its own sensibility and style in short fiction and essays. The first cover featured a Victorian dandy in a top hat looking through his monocle at a pink butterfly, drawn by Ray Irvin, who also designed the distinctive typeface of the New Yorker. The man Eustace Tilly appears on the cover of every anniversary edition. It was in 1947 on this date the inventor Edwin Land demonstrated the first instant camera, the Polaroid. The film, layered with little sacks of developing and fixing solutions, so after exposure, The film was squeezed between two rollers, which burst the sacks of chemicals, and 60 seconds later, there was your picture. It's the birthday of the novelist David Foster Wallace, born Ithaca, New York, 1962, author of Infinite Jest, which became a bestseller in 1996, even though it was more than 1,000 pages long with 100 pages of footnotes. Wallace battled devastating depression his whole life, committed suicide in 2008. His unfinished novel, The Pale King, published in 2011. He said, "Postmodern irony and cynicism has become an end in itself, a measure of hip sophistication and literary savvy. Few artists dare to try to talk about ways of working toward redeeming what's wrong because they'll look sentimental and naive to all the weary ironists. Irony has gone from liberating to enslaving. The postmodern founder's patricidal work was great, but patricide produces orphans, and no amount of revelry can make up for the fact that writers my age have been literary orphans throughout our formative years." Here's a poem for today by Michael Lasky entitled Nobody. If you can't bring yourself